Welcome to episode 383 of Troubadours and Raconteurs with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's episode, we feature a grand conversation with writer, musician, and our resident social critic, JQ. We talk about this nonstop panic, the pandemic, social justice, artists, freaks, poetic justice, or pure insanity, loving truly, caste systems, race, sex, banks, beautiful souls, among other things. It's a great, wonderful conversation with JQ on this week's episode. We have an EW essay titled Crazy Beautiful, and we share something from the August 3rd and 10th, 2020 edition of The New Yorker magazine, written by Tile Foggett, titled Department of Protesting Summer School, a poem titled Bald Heads. All of this will be infused, imbued with the wonderful energy of several great tunes. It is so nice to have you with us. Let's get to it. Episode 383 of Troubadours and Raconteurs. Crazy beautiful. The ground beneath these feet, find footing on myths of a nation so profound and discreet. All who live here together meet and propagate the seemingly boundless conceit, rooted in a sense of supremacy, with layers built on top of ideas of entitlement, handed down from one generation to the next. These keeping some in positions of power and advantage. The caste, the class, the color of your skin, the sex you are and the sex you have, the songs of your people seeking a truer understanding while navigating for survival, whispering within the thick of the din. As big-bellied, mustachioed purveyors of want position slendered, buxom babes on top of their laps, poolside positioned perfectly to taunt your earnest existence. You have so much to learn, so many books to read, a deep compulsion to craft and cultivate your own creed. Whilst too navigating the repercussions of humanity's misbegotten greed, as its inherent injustice manifests with a deprivation of so many bodies and souls, this societal tumult daily unravels and unfolds. Our need for gods and villains, good and evil, to define and design our paths, oh, so limit the beautiful bombast with which we might instead propel our species into the horizon from the past, with instead of fear-based dread, inspiration and deep love, feeding a collective strong heart and crazy beautiful head.
Comme ça d'une fille de rien,
mais c'est une personne très bien.
Je suis princesse d'un château
où tout est clair, où tout est beau.
Un grand jardin rempli de fleurs, dans le ciel bleu plane mon cœur. Des fleurs où d'arbres sont glaçants, sont toujours blanches comme mon le long des routes en se moquant du temps. Il chante pour qu'il écoute les cheveux dans le vent.
Bon, bon, bon.
C'est un vagabond qui est joli garçon. Il chante des chansons. La la. Mais cette histoire n'est pas vraie.
Ce n'est qu'un rêve qu'elle a fait.
Et quand je me suis éveillée,
le soleil était sur l'oreiller.
Et chaque soir quand je m'endors, je cherche en vain mon rêve d'or. Cette fois je quitterai mon château. Sur les routes en me moquant du temps, mais c'est mon cœur qui l'écoute, notre amour dans le vent.
Bon, bon, bon.
Hey JQ, is that you?
Yes, hello, how are you, EW?
I'm fine. Thank you once again for being on Troubadours and Rock on Tours. JQ is a regular contributor. For those of you who have not had the pleasure to hear his segment here on the program. He's been with us for quite some time. He is a writer, a musician. He is our resident social critic. Lives in the south of France. Been there for quite some time now, originally from these United States. An expat, I guess. Our global hobo, as he calls himself. And today... Yes, go ahead.
And you forgot to mention an excellent dancer.
An exceptional dancer. Yes. And he is busy with his summer ventures in the south of France. He's taken some time to sit with us, and we're going to talk a bit about, the state of affairs in the world, I suppose. There's a lot to talk about, JQ. How you doing, by the way?
Well, I'm hanging in there. Everything is very, very bizarre over here still, although I understand things have only gotten stranger and stranger over there. So I'm actually more interested in hearing from you this time about how things are over there, because I haven't been much in contact with friends from the States recently.
Well, you know, it's very perplexing. You know, I just got off of a Zoom meeting, which is all the rage here in the U.S., regarding how we are going to handle school, you know, education in the fall.
Right.
And, you know, it's very perplexing how you do it right, you know, and protect people and from getting sick with COVID-19, and at the same time making certain people have an opportunity to get a good education. And, of course, there's a political, for some reason, motivation or element to it for a lot of people. They don't believe the science so much, or they think they're being misinformed about the gravity of the situation. Their individual freedoms, they believe, oftentimes are being infringed upon when asked to quarantine or wear a mask or things of that nature to protect they themselves and you know, their fellow citizens from getting sick. So that, on top of all of that, then you have social justice issues that have come to a head. They're here always in our country and in the world, I think you would agree. But given what has occurred since the murder of George Floyd and subsequent other Breonna Taylor and other things that have come to light regarding people of color and how they're mistreated by our society, all of this together, on top of it being, you know, sequestered with your family and inside of a dwelling for long periods of time, could drive one crazy.
Yeah, that's the impression I'm getting. Like the last time, I've been very, very busy over here. It's tourist season, and I'm sort of actually working two jobs right now. But the last time I was in touch with somebody from the States, it was a friend in Philadelphia. And then I've had a few, you know, I have some people I correspond with writing, because we're old fashioned. We still write very long emails where we describe things in full paragraphs and sentences, you know, like old people do. Back, you know, those old fools from the days of, you know, literacy. Anyway, the general impression has been one of nonstop panic. Where there's a feeling that the whole jalopy is just flying downhill with no brakes. And, you know, it's hard. As somebody who was sort of against the grain in America when I lived there for so long, when I was young and into my late 20s, it's hard to adapt right away to the notion that it's any worse than it's always been, because we've sort of always had that feeling, if you see what I mean.
Oh, yeah. But, you mean yeah, like our group, the people that we hung out with, you mean?
Yeah, all the sort of artists and freaks and mountebanks that comprised our social circle. There was always a sort of general sense, I don't want to overstate this, but a sort of general sense that things were really spinning out of control. And, you know, we were screaming about that back in the 90s, the early 90s. And it only got worse since, but it does seem recently, you know, that things have kicked into a gear that we've never known before, in terms of just the sense of chaos and of a sort of an accelerating collapse of our culture and civilization under its the weight of its own fictions. You know, one of the main ones being the racial fiction, you know, and that should be exploding now in the middle of coronavirus, COVID-19. I don't know if that's poetic justice or if it's just pure insanity, but that's happening too. You know, Donald Trump brings it to a head. We've for decades been making people famous simply because they're famous, which is a very strange thing. You know, the
Andy Warhol.
Except he actually had a sort of talent, right? So
no, I mean his prediction in a way. I was
everybody would be famous for 50. Yeah, I got you. I got you. But you know, the Kim Kardashian syndrome, the Paris Hilton syndrome, just people who are just famous just because they're famous, and celebrity being this. And finally, we just elected one president, and now we're paying the price. So I don't know. You know, our culture in particular, the racial thing, I don't know what to say about it because, you know, anything you do say, even if it's wise, things are so highly charged that I must be speaking from my protected, you know, bubble of a life as a Caucasian. So I don't know what to say, except that if you read the book Sapiens, which was a big bestseller, can't remember the author's name, but he makes a very salient point about how one of the great American myths that our society lives by, you know, the lie that makes a civilization work. In India, it was the caste system, for instance. Back in ancient Sumer, Hammurabi, he divided the Hammurabi's code or whatever it's called. He divided society into the superior men, the commoners, and the slaves. And people fell into those categories, and you were either property or you had some rights or you had all the rights. And people believed it. Because that was the social code. America, as opposed to like England, where it was very much a class system and based on accent and all of this, we did it by race from very early on. And it's this myth that we've been living by, you know. And so the myth is collapsing along with the myth of our superiority and our economy and all sorts of other things. So I understand everybody over there that I've been in contact with, even though I've been out of touch for a while, feels completely out of control. There's a new note of panic that I haven't really heard before. So that's why I'm curious to know from you where you're at.
Well, you know, I'm reading even more history than I have in the past. You know, I've always been privy to Howard Zinn's People's History of the U.S., mm-hmm. which is a different sort of history that you hear normally in school systems and the like. And a lot of what I read, you know, there's so much I still don't know. And I realize I've been misinformed about or things that have just been totally ignored. And that's frustrating. How could you have an informed, intelligent understanding of where you are now as part of a society if you really don't know where you have been? Yeah. Right. You know, things like mass murder of people in Oklahoma. Black people in particular because they were successful. You never heard about that particular incident in history books. The fact that for years teachers have told students in middle schools and high schools in the United States that the Civil War was about states' rights, not slavery. Balderdash, you know. People like Woodrow Wilson, who's lauded as a great American leader, was a racist and a sexist and a classist. Yeah. And these, you know, these things need to be known. They need to be analyzed. We need to embrace them and take ownership of them. Even, you know, the police state that exists in the United States of America really aggravates me. It has forever, ever since you know me. You've known me forever. I've always questioned this just... This sort of ease that people and willingness people have to bow down to authority and to automatically hold people up as heroes or something. When you know, a hero, there are heroes, but heroes are few and far between. Just because you put on a certain outfit, you shouldn't then expect to, or no one should, just bow down and laud that individual. It's based on their actions. And often our police do not do as good as they need to do. And we have tanks positioned in every little borough in town to celebrate war. We have our police officers walking around with military gear and training as if they're going to go to war. And it sickens me. The money wasted, the mentality that it projects into our communities, and how people are just buying into it, are indoctrinated into it, you know. So that all of that stuff is on my mind as of late, if that makes any sense to you.
Yeah, no. It makes a lot of sense to me, because I've shared that point of view for a long time. I mean, it's one of the reasons I'm over here. You know, I did leave America for a reason. There's a lot I love about America, and I'm very much an American, you know, and you especially see it and feel it when you live in another culture and have to adapt to it. There's all sorts of little habits and assumptions that are part of your psychological makeup that you don't realize are culturally conditioned until you find yourself living in another culture, right? And it's not like I moved to Senegal or to India or to some place. I've spent a lot of time there, but, you know, to some place really different. I'm still in the West. I'm in France. And yet there are a lot of massive differences culturally. Look, America's a tortured civilization. There's a lot to love, but it's been turning over to the dark side of the force. For me, politically, it really starts in the Reagan-Thatcher era. Globally, really, the takeover of capital and the death of real social politics begins then. And the moving of the Overton window in American politics in particular, so far right that there is no such thing as a left anymore to speak of in America. There are some good commentators, but there's no real political left, or very little. Bernie Sanders has revived it, right? Mm-hmm. And you need it as a counterweight, because the left and the right need to coexist. It's like the two wings of a bird, you know? So when that whole system is out of balance, as it is, well, then the flight becomes very rocky.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a disturbing thing. It's hard to know what to say when there's so much happening at once. When, you know, I hear a lot, I see people on social media raging about Trump all the time. I he's a symptom to me. You know,
right.
Obviously he's a huge problem, but it's so much deeper than that. It's so much deeper. How the fact that he could get there is the real problem. That's what needs to be examined, to me, to my way of thinking. You know, of course, then again, he's here and you have to deal with that.
Right.
You're in this room now, not another one. So that's where we're at, man. It's tough. And, you know, coronavirus has been handled really, really badly over there. Here, things were strict for a little while. Now we're starting to see, I don't know, there's also public panic involved with certain things in Europe, and a lot of political maneuvering going on. It's quite complicated. And I think you guys are in a phase over there where all you want to hear about really is, like, let's do everything we can to quarantine. But here's the thing. Economically, the reality is people are in deep trouble. And I don't know if you saw this, but all right. Well, you're familiar with how the banks and the government, the Federal Reserve and so on, they injected, I think it was $2.3 trillion into the stock market back when it was collapsing, in an effort to prop it up. Do you remember this?
We're talking back when Obama took over, and Bush, and from the Bush to Obama era.
No. We're talking about the quarantine when the stock market collapsed and the banks injected $2.3 trillion.
I have to say, I plead ignorance.
All right. Well, do you remember how they opened the stock market? And then, you know, they have that like emergency red bat button now that you can just shut the stock market down if it starts to collapse.
Yes, I do remember that.
Okay, because they didn't have it back in, you know, the 2008, the last time things really went haywire. So they have that now, and the banks injected all this money into the stock market to prop it up, right, to make people feel secure, to create psychological security in the markets. And then they opened the markets and they had to shut it down. I think it was in like 5 minutes or something ridiculous like that. This is back in March or April when things were first going haywire, right? And we were under quarantine here in France when this happened. And so that was $2.3 trillion that just came out of nowhere. You know, we have to stop and ask, you know, when they're telling us that we're injecting $2.3 trillion into the stock market, you have to say, where did you get it? Well, that's very complicated to explain, but they sort of create it, right? Which is revelatory that they have that power to do that. And what's more revelatory is the stock market, which is supposed to be a measure of our the health of our economy, really benefits at best, like really truly benefits about 5% of the population. You know, most people aren't making money, anything significant off the stock market. So it's not a real indicator of what's actually happening for real Americans at all, at all, at all. So they inject this $2.3 trillion into the stock market. And then it within 2 days, poof, it was gone. It came from nowhere and it went nowhere. But now there's this massive debt added to the debt. So here's the thing. Somebody did the math, which it turns out is pretty simple. If you take working age Americans, you know, between 18 and retirement age, regardless of their actual income or whether they're employed or not, simply if they're fit for work, right? That's about 100 million people. So if you take that $2.3 trillion and you want to get through the crisis, instead of trying to prop up the stock market with this money you created out of thin air, right? And that is a debt for our grandchildren. If you had simply divided it up and given it to every working age adult in America, that's $23,000 per person.
Wow.
For a couple, that's
changed lives.
For a couple, that's $46,000. You want to get through the crisis, shut everything down, but, you know, and then pay extra money to essential services, delivery people, nurses, all of that, and really quarantine? They had the money to do it. Our economy is a fiction, and not in the conspiracy theory sense. It's sort of, it's more of a shell game. It is tied to a lot of real wealth, but the fact is that only about 7% of money circulating in the world exists in paper form. It's computer algorithms, and technically it's tied to real wealth and has real value, but it's a massive fiction that we, that's the myth we live by. It's like, you know, the resurrection of Jesus, or Muhammad is the great prophet, or, you know, believing that the Buddha will lead you to enlightenment. That's the myth we live by, is our economy. It's a social fiction. It's like the Indian caste system. It keeps cohesion because we believe in it, but it's not real. And a crisis like this sort of gives you a glimpse backstage behind the curtain to where the Wizard of Oz is pulling on the levers, right?
Well said. Well said. JQ here on Troubadours and Rock on Tours, our resident social critic, talking with us at his place in the south of France. Maybe we shouldn't tell people exactly. They might come and find you. I fully expect someone's going to like grab you right now while we're talking and drag you out of the room you're sitting in.
Shut him up, right?
Yeah, well, you know what? They probably just look at us as peons anyway.
Yeah, right? That is getting conspiratorial. Yeah, they don't care what I say. They don't care.
No. Laugh at you. They laugh at you.
Yeah. Listen to him. He thinks he's got it figured out.
Yeah. Well, you know, I like what you're saying. It makes total sense to me, and it gives you a handle on things when you feel totally confused and as if you're the only one who knows something's not quite right. So it's helpful in that regard. But when you truly look at what any individual can do, you know, you don't want to get cynical. You want to be realistic. And I guess the things that we can do, if you truly, believe the problems that we're talking about do exist, is work together, you know, in a peaceful but intelligent manner where you are willing to persevere for years, and probably you're going to have to pass it on to another group. You're not going to see all of what you want accomplished, of course, like a John Lewis, right? God rest his soul. You take beatings, you get stronger, your wisdom gets deeper, you continue to work for what you believe is right, what is just, and then you pass, and you've inspired people, hopefully, and then they take on and the reins, so to speak, and keep moving forward.
Yeah. I mean, you do what you can because the game is rigged. You know, you can look at that as being, humans are the victims of their own success as a species. All right. Homo sapiens. You know, there used to be like a bunch of humanoid species. There was Homo erectus lived for millions of years. Right. But there was never.
This is a family show.
Yeah, well, okay, Neanderthals, Homo erectus, there was a bunch of them, Homo florensis, you know, we wiped them all out.
I was making fun of the arrest. I was being
sophomoric. Yeah, I get it. I'm pretending it didn't happen because it was so not funny. So I'm just ignoring
the erectus part. It was the erectus part. You know.
Oh wait, because it sounds like erection. Oh.
Beep 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 beep.
So anyway, you know, you've destroyed my point. I can't go on.
Folks, we've been hanging out since we're like, you know, in junior high, and sometimes that junior high connection comes out again, you know.
Yeah, no, that was actually, if symbolically, you just did to me what American culture has done to 2,000 years of human culture. It just comes along. We had philosophers, we had Schopenhauer and Nietzsche and classical music, and America just comes along and goes, oh, look, fart, and you know,
and farts in the White House now.
Yeah, yeah, and we elect a fart president, and there you go. That's my country, 'tis of thee. So I totally forget what we were talking about next.
You were talking about how we as a species
we're a victim of our own success.
You're listening to Troubadours and Rock on Tours with E.W. Conundrum Demure on WFTE Radio, Mount Cobb and Scranton, Pennsylvania. Community radio at its finest.
Yeah. Yes. Look, I mean, when you were talking about somebody like John Lewis, you know, truly inspirational people who spend their whole lives bashing their head against the wall just to get a brick to fall out, you know, as other people are up top putting more bricks on top of the wall. but, you know, beautiful souls, people who really, really work for change, and there's so many ways to do that. It can be politically, culturally, socially, artistically, or just in your community. But it seems to be that beyond local community level, things get very, very tricky. You know, the average human cannot have a real existent social circle beyond the maximum seems to be between 100 and 150 people that you really know well and that you can actually have some sort of connection with. Beyond that, we get lost. And that actually happens to be the maximum number of tribes, for instance, of chimpanzees. They'd never get bigger than that because beyond that, cooperation becomes impersonal and therefore impossible. And the reason humans can do it is because we have myths and because we have fictions, like our economy, like the Indian caste system, like the, you know, the American exceptionalism, these things that we create that allow us to cooperate for something that, you know, impersonally, that is beyond us. Even if it's a lie. And through these mass cooperations, we've created first, you know, city states, then nations and empires, and now something like a global economy. But the thing is, part and parcel of that is that it's incredibly dehumanizing at the same time. And, you know, the old saying, power corrupts, as Lord Acton says, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And so every system seems to collapse under its own weight of corruption at some point. And ours seems to be rapidly approaching that. But the strange thing now is that we have a globally interlinked economic system along with all the nation states. And so where does that lead? I mean, can it be strong enough, the global connectivity and therefore interdependence that we have to sort of save humanity from... Can it stop America from collapsing? Because the rest of the world needs Americans to consume if we want this game to keep going. That's something we don't like to talk about too much, right?
No, we do not.
And so, yeah, it can make you very cynical. To get back to your point, it's why I said the game is rigged against you. That's just on the basic level. Also, existentially, metaphysically, you know, if you will, you could say, look, you're born into a universe of infinite information, but you have a very finite intelligence. There's infinite time, but you only have a few years to figure everything out. You can't. You won't. You don't get to win. The only thing you get to do, and your example was John Lewis, was to sort of fight the good fight. So are you going to do that? And will you find the cause to do it for? You know, mine has been creativity. And I've done what I can. You know, I haven't sold out. I've stayed creative and continued making art my whole adult life. And I don't worry about what happens to it or what other people say about it. I just keep creating it because the victory is in that. And I'm going to get back to doing it after I talk to you, right? As soon as possible. So, but, you know, maybe that's a silly choice, but whatever the choice is, you have to make it. And we only get to have, I think, Pyrrhic victories, sadly. And that's a tough philosophy, but I don't see a way out of it. It seems true.
Yeah, it does. And, I guess, too, it's a bit about how grandiose you think your existence is. You know, we're here to do what? You know, what are we here to accomplish? How important are we? Who are we important to? All these are very deep questions I'm always, you know, reflecting on. I mean, you want justice. You don't want to see people treated poorly or abused, tortured even, you know, we see in this world for sure. But at the same time, you know, what are you trying to win as a person? Is it, how much of it is self-serving? How much of it is sort of, immature, I guess you could say, emotionally, or even intellectually, when you realize as you just really clearly explained to us the state of affairs that we face in a lifetime. I love how you put, you know, there's so much there, and our intelligence is limited, and our time is limited. So, yeah, it's a weird experience, this one we're given, this life that we're given.
That's I don't call myself a Christian, but I read a very, very wonderful essay by a guy named Timothy Garton Ash in the London Review of Books many years ago, where he said something, because he is a Christian writer, he believes in the theology and the philosophy of Christianity, but he's more of a Kierkegaardian type. For Kierkegaard is somebody that every human should have to confront at some point. He's a brilliant man. But to sum up, his idea of Christianity, I would have subscribed to. And what he said was the message of the cross, and that most people who call themselves Christians do not want to hear, is quite simple and very, very hard. Hard as a diamond. It is this. If you do not love truly, you are already dead. But if you do love truly, they will kill you. Now, that's a catch-22, right? But it's pretty much, it sums up what we've been saying. And here's the thing. What you have been given in this life is the opportunity to try to love truly. So raise your kids right. Be loyal. All those corny things, you know. I get, like, to me, and then also the thing, because I've felt it in me since I was very young, be creative, be imaginative, create things. Make some beauty, you know, or some honesty, if you will, because art doesn't have to be beautiful. It can be ugly, but as long as it's honest, as long as it's saying something, right? That's been my road, and I'm still on it, and I'm good here. But you don't get any reward except doing it. But that should be enough. I think that's the tough nut to crack. Is that the opportunity to try, to have been given this life? That's what's precious. Because look around us, man. Everything's falling apart. You know, nobody's in control. You know, no, there's nobody at the wheel. God's away on business, as Tom Waits put it.
And I think that's a good place to leave our conversation.
On that happy note, buy my new record.
we're going to play one of your tunes immediately after we're done with our conversation here. Do you want to lead in?
Well, a new artist name. I'm thinking about calling the band. I've got people I've been working with. I've been writing and performing with various people. And we've been looking for a name. It's all my music, but I think we're going to call it This Quintessence of Dust. So you can put that in as the new artist name for this song. This one is called Rose. There's acoustic guitars and cellos and chants and all sorts of things going on in it. It's quite a moody number, and it's basically about how we betrayed the poetic soul, femininity in nature. We hunted it down and killed it, and now we're paying the price for it.
Again, another really inspiring thought.
It's another party start and toe tapper.
Thank you so much, JQ. You're my brother. I love you. I wish I could hug you and kiss you right now, hopefully soon.
Yes, yes. Well, social distancing. That's all I have to say to that. Love you too, man. Thanks for having
Ciao.
Me.
Ciao. Bye. My pleasure. And this is from the New Yorker magazine, the August 3rd and 10th edition, 2020. Department of Protesting Summer School by Tyler Foggett. Bartley Janotte teaches 6th grade humanities at the Abington Friends School, a private Quaker institution in the North Philadelphia suburb of Jenkintown. When schools closed for the pandemic in March, he was teaching via Zoom within days. "It was pretty easy for us to pivot to distance learning," he said, because of his school's resources. Meanwhile, kids in the public schools were just at home, getting no interaction from their teachers for almost a month, he added. Before joining Abington Friends last year, Janotte taught at the Philadelphia School, another private institution. A decade earlier, he attended Seton Hall Prep, a Catholic boys' school in New Jersey, where he was one of 24 black students in a class of around 200. He got good grades, but he grew frustrated with the curriculum of all-white authors. "I felt like I was reading other people's literature, other people's theology, other people's history," he said. "I was looking for something that spoke more to my experience. It was like the second to last chapter of the book that we never got to." When he asked his teachers about incorporating more black voices, the school sent a letter to his mother. His teachers had noted a, quote, radical shift in his behavior, describing him as, quote, hostile and, quote, aggressive. After that, Janotte stayed quiet in class. "But the world is a little different now." This summer, Janotte is teaching a free course for inner-city high schoolers called Protest Writing. It is hosted by Mighty Writers, a local nonprofit. The reading list ranges from W.E.B. Du Bois to Nicole Hannah-Jones and Kendrick Lamar, and the class culminates in the students writing their own pieces. The other day, after 8 students had shown up for class over Zoom, Janotte shared his screen so that they could view a political cartoon. The drawing, titled The American Dream Game, showed 2 boys, one white and one black, taking different paths to get to the end of the game board. The white kid's path was straight and short, while the black kid's was 3 times as long, winding through such obstacles as segregation, lose 25 turns. Federico, a sophomore in a green shirt, raised his hand. "White people tend to judge African Americans, saying they're slow or something like that, when in reality, they just have a lot more things to overcome in order to reach that American dream," he said. Zion Perry, a junior who wore her hair in braids, chimed in. "Some white people are so comfortable in what they have or where they are that if they see a person of color in the same position as them, then they think that they both got to that place in the same way." Janotte asked the class, "How do you think that this board might look if, instead of a black man, this was a black woman?" A sophomore named Felix, whose webcam was positioned so that only the top half of his face was visible, guessed that the path would look even twistier. He said that he had heard black women talk about the disrespect that they get from various groups, including black men. "It must be really hard if you feel like even the people inside of your own race don't respect you," he said. "I like what Felix said a lot," Perry said. She describes some of the difficulties of being a black woman. "When we're passionate or loud about something, we're seen as ghetto. But when we try to conform to societal standards, we're whitewashed." On to homework. The students had been asked to read a piece in the Times about how 2 schools, one private and one public, had adjusted to remote learning. They talked about the failings of their own public schools. Perry, who goes to the Academy of the New Church, a private school in the affluent suburb of Bryn Athyn, said that her school had done a bad job transitioning to remote learning, too. "It really showed you how they actually felt about you," she said, explaining that her teachers hadn't seemed to care whether she fell behind on her work. This past June, she began posting on Instagram about experiencing racism at her school. She also wrote about it for Jenote's class. In a two-page poem titled The Masked Prisoner, she compares the school's instructors to prison guards. They were terrible overseers, and their titles were teachers. I was taught Latin and European, and even how to be like one. And describes how they seemed to favor some students over others. The victims that were always seen as nice and kind and so sweet and oh so pretty and white. A spokesperson for the Academy of the New Church responded in a statement. We support all our students, alumni, and families in courageously speaking out about the hurt they experienced while attending our schools, and we thank them for sharing input on how to make our schools better. Perry's parents plan to enroll her in a new school this fall. In her poem, she writes, COVID came around and the killer saved my life.
bald heads. How these yellow petals of flower float on airstreams that also carry sounds of gunfire, because the ignorant bald heads want to train in vain their small-minded ways and ideas of protecting our community.
I feel tears welling up cold deep inside, like my heart sprung a big break. And a stab of loneliness, sharp and painful, more than I can take. You might have thought I was taking it hard when you broke it off with a call. But don't you wager I'm gonna hide my sorrow, might break right down and ball. Now the race is on and it comes right up the backstretch. Heartaches cutting through my inside. My tears are holding back, trying not to fall. My heart's out of the running, two loves catch for another's sake. Now the race is on and it's looking like heartache, and the winner gonna lose it all. One day I'll wager in love, never once suspecting what the final result will be. And I live in fear, waking up each morning, finding that you're gone for me. As an aching pain in my heart for the day was the one that I hated to face. Somebody new come up to win her, and I ended up in second place. Now the race is on and it comes right up the backstretch. Heartache cutting through my inside. Tears are holding back, trying not to fall. My heart's out of the running, two loves catch for another's sake. Now the race is on and it's looking like heartache, and the winner gonna lose it all.
And there you have it, episode 383 of Troubadours and Raconteurs, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. First and foremost, our resident social critic, our good friend J.Q. I would like to thank writer Tyler Fogat and the New Yorker magazine, and these musical artists: Django Reinhardt, Stefan Grappelli, David Bowie, Edith Piaf, J.Q., Zero Seven, Charlie Crockett, Branford Marsalis, and of course Terrence Blanchard too. And I'd like to thank you for listening. Until next time, let's give it a go and do our best with this time. Take care.